Hello and welcome. It's Thursday and you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and in with me today, Mr. Tim Dennis. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Very good.
Good. I know we didn't get you in every day of the week as we had originally promised, but 3 days, I'll take 3 days.
Okay.
3 days works. We're working on schedules are just clashing with me being out of town, your health issues. It's just been in and out. So we're going to try to get together as often as we can.
Okay.
For the episodes.
I like it.
Tomorrow, though, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Raymond Moody. And, you know, Dr. Moody has been a great asset to our show over the years. Fascinating man, kind of considered to be the godfather of near-death experiences.
Oh, yes.
And talking about things like the psychomantium. We'll be discussing tomorrow the Oracle of the Dead, communication, and the different methodologies. Plus, he kind of throws a challenge out to me, Tim. I've already recorded this episode, but he invites me to be a part of an experiment.
Really?
I'm going to do it.
Huh.
So I'm going to see if we can confront Dave's fear of death and get it under wraps.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't say.
I do say. I just said. Why don't you pay attention?
I really should pay more attention.
All right. Tonight, though, interesting show. I love when we can kind of go off of the ghosties and UFOs and Bigfoot and talk about something a little bit different. Joining us tonight, and God, please be with me as my tongue tries to wrap myself around these names. I love foreign names, Tim, but they're brutal on my tongue. Moira Lesquier. I think I got it. Is that right, Moira?
Very good. You said it perfectly.
Oh, well, I don't believe you, but thanks for trying to be polite. You've written a book called Atlantis and the Legendary Blue Queen, which is a novel, but you based it on a lot of information and truth on a lot of different really interesting kind of secrets and lost bits of our history. What made you decide to write a book like this?
Oh, well, it did take quite some time. It didn't sort of happen straight away. I spent 7 years writing it, at least a decade researching it. It just sort of it came about once I got started with writing the book. The book basically wrote itself through my dreams, through I faced a bit of hardship at one time in my life, and I did go to see a clairvoyant in Byron Bay in Australia, and she had basically started talking about my spiritual guides, and she recognized my great-grandmother whom I met when I was 8 years old and in Malta. And she was my first spiritual teacher, and she came through very strongly, being very supportive. And also she mentioned
what was that like for you to have that kind of meeting and have this kind of relation come back to you and validate and give you information? Was that something that you were really prepared for, or was it pretty astounding?
Well, it was astounding because they described her with the pentacles in the position of a third eye. And I knew it was her because she was always very highly intuitive and spiritual. And, you know, my first encounter with her was really just she planted the seeds of curiosity in my mind from a very young age and really shaped, you know, my future endeavors. At that time, I didn't realize how much she had impacted me. And when she came through with all this support, I didn't feel so much alone anymore. And I knew that, you know, she would be there guiding me, you know, along the way, and not to sort of be so hard on myself about everything that was going on at that particular time. And also she described what was even more interesting is she described an old priest on my left-hand side. He didn't want to talk to her. He didn't want to say anything except that he has a family secret. And it was up to me to find out what this secret was all about. You know, he wasn't really going to divulge any information to her. Basically, he's saying, I'm here for you, and you do the research and you find out the answers of what secrets are in our family, and you know, you write about it. So, and when I was writing the book,
you didn't find that kind of disingenuous? I mean, here the spirits make this connection with you only to say, well, I'm not going to give you the information, you got to do that yourself, but I'm going to lead you down a puzzled pathway to try to get that information.
Well, I was sort of a bit annoyed that he wouldn't really talk to her.
Right, right.
It pushed me to sort of search for answers. And then I had another gentleman who was also, you know, clairvoyant. And And he said that he was like a shaman priest. And I actually gave him a name, Peter, because I wanted to give him a name. He always sort of appeared in a black coat, and he sort of always scared me to a certain degree. And then in the book, I associated him with Father Margry. He was not related to our family, not blood related, but, you know, he played a major role in archaeology in Malta, and he was not just a Jesuit priest, he was also an archaeologist, and he died unexpectedly when he was sent off in a mission to Tunisia, Libya, at quite a young age. So, but he was actually the first Jesuit priest, because he was also an archaeologist, to inspect the Hypogeum of House Sofini, where they discovered these mysterious elongated, which are also known as docephalic skulls.
Okay.
The long, posterior at the back. It sort of all gelled together when I was writing the book. The priest always came across as a mysterious sort of figure. And he sort of reminded me of Thoth, the writing god, because, you know, when I was working with Barry Eaton.
Moira, I need you to get as close as you can to the microphone. I want to make sure we can hear the whole story, but your voice keeps dipping in and out on us a little bit.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes, much better. Thank you. So you're getting this information, and it's being given to you. Now, is he stringing it? Is he giving you tips and hints and places to look, or how do you start this kind of research with such basic non-information?
I did research, and you know, once I started looking into what Father Margry, you know, found at the House Sofini Hypogeum in Paola, I started to sort of join it all up. And whenever I got lost, my dreams would sort of put the puzzle together, and it all gelled together when I was writing the book, and that's, I feel, because of I've got those strong spiritual guides there, you know, helping me to find the way.
So the guides were helping you find the way. You're pointed in this direction. You start doing this research, and it speaks to you. So you start to feel a connection, so you know that you're on the right path.
Yes, that's correct.
As you're uncovering these different mysteries and parts of history, is there any part of it that you start to reflect on as though you almost have memory of it taking place? Like, do you believe that you were there, reincarnated at one point?
I've got a very strong connection to the Maltese archipelago, and like, I've had all sorts of strange dreams, like, you know, some of them are quite strange to even to mention, but there is that strong connection, and I feel like I have lived some kind of life, a different form of human, like an aquatic type of human.
You can't leave us back with that, Moira. When you say you've had weird dreams that are almost too hard to explain, you've got to explain them to us. What type of dreams are you having, so that if there are others out there having similar dreams that seem out of place in time for them, maybe they are connected as well, so they know what to look for?
Sure. Well, one dream, for example, I was swimming with killer whales, and I was involved in some sort of genetic engineering where I was actually collecting their sperm to do genetic engineering, because we were like a different type of human. I in the dream, I had really long legs. I don't even know if I had feet. And I had an elongated skull. I was a different type of human. And I wasn't afraid of these aquatic beings, like the killer whales, the dolphins. The water was my home. It was like a natural home to me. So,
do you think that you were some kind of scientist? Is that why you were collecting the semen from the killer whales?
I was doing genetic engineering. So, and they were working with me, like we were. It was my job to do that.
And you're having this kind of dreams. Did you have tactile sensations while you were having these dreams? Like, you you know, I mean, we feel kind of disassociated with our dreams. Not many times do we feel connected unless it's like a visitation or sometimes a premonition dream. Was there any kind of sensation of like, could you literally feel the water? Could you, you know, hear the sounds of the waves? Was it that detailed for you?
Yes, it was. So, yeah, I could see my body. I could see what I was doing. I always see in color when I dream. And I remember, and I actually during this dream, I got woken up, and so I remembered it instantly. And I associated Peter as Thoth, the master scribe, and this is the old priest that I saw on the other side, on my left-hand side, I think it was. I've always felt very guided, whether it's with dreams or when I'm just sitting at my computer typing away. The direction just comes, so it's a bit like automatic typing rather than writing, I suppose.
And when you're having this dream and you're realizing that you're working kind of on this genetics, aside from this, are you seeing where you go? Is there a lab? Are you underwater? Is it above water? What can you tell us about this?
No, it's all underwater, and I was holding like a test tube, and I could notice that my body was different, that my head, I had long legs. I never saw my feet, so I don't know if I had any feet, but, yeah, it was quite vivid, and all the feelings and emotions were there. And the feelings were that, you know, we humans worked very strongly and very closely with aquatic mammals as part of our theory. In the book, I do talk about the aquatic ape theory quite a bit, you know, pointing to that our origins, you know, as sea levels rose, the environments change, and our human ancestors adapted to a more aquatic existence, and that sort of linked in with the dream.
And what were you getting from this? I mean, was there a sense of any kind of sense of doom? Were you guys, you know, were you sensing an end to your race, to your civilization at all during any of these dream facets? Like you were looking in on windows of your past?
Yes, I believe I felt like I was looking into, you know, a past life, that I had a highly aquatic sort of existence, and that perhaps, you know, humans were more aquatic in the past than evolving from apes.
All right. Now, you mentioned the fact that you believe you had like an elongated skull as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. And do you get a sense from these feelings of any kind of direction of where this land would have been? Obviously, we're talking about like an Atlantis or Lemuria or something. Do you have a sense of where this may exist?
Sure. Look, well, Edgar Cayce mentions that Atlantis was destructed at least three times. And I believe that the third, you know, the last Atlantis was in a central Mediterranean location, making Malta and the surrounding area, you know, a very good candidate.
And do you feel a pull to that area? I mean, has that been a place that you've gone to visit and try to connect with?
Sure. Well, yes, I was born there, in Valletta, the capital city. And then when I was 2 years old, my parents immigrated to Australia. But I've been there several times to visit, you know, friends and relatives. So yes, there is a pull to the place. You know, it's a beautiful island, you know, great beaches, great, you know, social life. Yes, it's a fabulous place to visit. So yes, I do have, you know, an attraction to the place.
Is there any, has there been any kind of archaeological finds that would lead us to start to believe that this might be the genesis point for Atlantis?
Yes, well, I have done quite a bit of research. Like, for example, Diodorus Siculus, a Greek historian, described, you know, a trip from the Pillars of Hercules, to the island of Ibiza next to Spain, that it takes 3 days. Now, the Pillars of Hercules is supposed to be in front of Atlantis, Now, it can't be Spain or Gibraltar, you know, the south of Spain, because according to Siculus, it only takes 12 hours. So I acted a bit like a private investigator and looked at all the nitty-gritty of, you know, what Plato had written in Critias and Timaeus, in the dialogues there. And it, basically, the Pillars of Hercules is likely to be in the vicinity of Sicily and Malta, not Gibraltar.
All right. Now, why do we give so much credence to the words of Plato? Why did he know so much about this, but no one else seemed to really have a memory or an understanding of this at his time?
Well, I believe Plato went in search for Atlantis, so he, you know, travelled around, and then in his dialogues, he wrote, you know, a good description of Atlantis.
Right, but do you understand why did he go looking for it? I mean, if we don't know that it even existed, what was the spark that started him on that journey? Do you have any clue on that?
Well, he heard the story from, I think it was a great uncle, Solon. And then he, you know, they spoke to the Egyptian priest Sanchez. I suppose they were curious as to, you know, to find out, you know, this, where this great island was, this mighty power of Atlantis, you know, situated in the front of the Pillars of Hercules.
So and I'm not trying to sound dismissive, but I mean, we base a lot of this on the stories of, a great uncle and a guy named Sanchez?
Yes, Sanchez was the Egyptian priest.
Okay. Because that just seems weird to me. Is there any writings that we can find that predate them that talk about this? So it's not, I mean, and I don't mean to be sarcastic, but as, you know, you're thinking in common day thoughts, I've got a couple of uncles who've told a couple of tall tales in their time. And, you know, part of it to entertain a part of us, you know, part of it to entertain us, part of it just because they were BS artists. I mean, how do we know that's not what they were doing?
Well, everyone, you know, like Atlantis seems to fascinate a lot of people.
Right.
So somewhere deep down inside us, it seems to, you know, intrigue a lot of people. I mean, thousands of books and comics and movies have been made about Atlantis. So I understand it's a legend, but there are also some, you know, some truth and facts in legends. And, you know, a lot of these elongated skulls that have been found, like, in the Hypogeum, like, there were 7,000 skulls, elongated skulls found in the Hypogeum of Paola, and only six remain. And at one stage in the 1920s, they were displayed in the Archaeological Museum of Valletta, and then they were taken away from public view. But our existence does point, like, we've come from somewhere else. Like, we've obviously evolved to where we are today from some other race.
But we know that there are different cultures that do things and look at beauty in different ways. I mean, the elongated skulls, they would bind the skull of a baby at a very small age to create that elongated look. We know that, you know, some of the women in the Chinese culture bind their feet so that they're almost like walking on cubes. You know, 50 years ago, Marilyn Monroe was considered the perfect woman. Now she's considered a fat and out of shape model. You know, I mean, there's always kind of a change of how beauty is perceived and different looks. There's cultures where they put rings on the neck and try to elongate the necks. Does this mean that it has an alien or a prehistory connection, or is it just people are constantly on the look for, you know, a new appearance?
Sure. No, these were naturally elongated skulls that were actually missing the knitting, like the sagitta is the technical term. They were natural. They weren't. There was no headboarding to elongate the skull. These were naturally elongated skulls. So it's like they were a different race of people that had different capabilities, like they had sonar capabilities. They were able to detect magnetism, ley lines, so that they could build these beautiful Neolithic temples that were trefoil in shape. So they were different to us. They were human, but they had different skills, different abilities that we can't even comprehend today because our skulls are different. So yeah, so there was
a completely different race. Were they part of our human ancestry, or were they just a different? And the reason I ask this is if the world has been kind of shaken and stirred numerous times through history and reboots with whatever genetic cesspool we come crawling out of, you know, is each evolution a different style? Does that really make us from the same, or does that make us new iterations altogether?
I think we're evolved from that aquatic, that elongated skulls. The elongated skulls were like supposed to be the leaders, the priests, a bit like Akhenaten and Nefertiti. You know, they're depicted with those elongated skulls. They were the elite of society, the shining ones, the Elohim. And it was interesting how they were taken away from the public eye, because you know these skulls really did need to be investigated because they were not manipulated. They were all genetically natural. There was no manipulation, and this is what Father Margry, he was the first to go into the House of Fini Hypogene in Paola, Malta, and he discovered these skulls, and then he was called away on a mission to Tunisia, and that's where he died unexpectedly. And they were, it's also believed that the elongated skulls were connected to the divine feminine, the matriarchy as well. They had a different sort of, where the left and right brain approach is more balanced, so they tended to live more in harmony with society rather than be more destructive and look to go to war. A bit like, you know, the bee, you know, collective societies like the bees and the ants.
So, you know, like a hive mentality.
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right. And in doing this, what information were you most surprised by that you were being given through your research and through these dreams?
Just that, you know, there's more to our existence. There's more to it than what we are being told of where we've come from. And, you know, the more I wrote and the more I researched and kept on dreaming, the more I felt like my inner radar was being activated, and just more awake, not just, you know, that, you know, they're going to discover more inhabitable planets and records of civilizations before us. It's just a matter of time, you know. And these races mastered the physical continuum and progressed beyond this world. And as with everything, those who approached it with a greater good for the collective in mind, to enhance beauty and consciousness, made progress. But others who were negative, individualistic, and greedy ultimately failed. So, you know, the veil for me just became thinner with the more research I did, and I feel that our race has evolved from this sort of aquatic, elongated race who are highly female in origin. I talk about the jackal in the book, who was sort of the experiment gone wrong with the Nomos, who are this aquatic race. I did look at the Dogon tribe in Mali, and looked into their myths, and all of this information sort of matched what I had discovered in Malta. And it all sort of just, you know, like kept on, the research kept on repeating itself and form. It just fell nicely into place.
Well, do you think that it's being kept, the knowledge is being kept from us, or is it not being shared because it's incomplete and nobody has the full story?
I believe that we're not getting the full story. I think that, you know, we need to use our own discernment and look into how what we're feeling and what you know, looking at, for example, when I looked into the Dogon religion and the Nomos and these aquatic beings that came from another star system, and they had to mix their DNA with, you know, the humans or the animals that were on the planet, you can see that it appears that there was a lot of genetic engineering going away to create, you know, these single-sex beings, because the Nomos were hermaphrodite. They were both male and female, and they were sort of fertilizing. And it just all sort of – and they had that elongated sort of sonar you know, elongated skulls of the sonar ability, and they used their senses more. But it was a more balanced left-right approach. And then when they created the jackal, the first single-sex being, which was the male, so it was the bad boy, he was continually looking for his other half. And he wreaked havoc all over the place until never really finding his other half, I don't think. He never sort of fitted in because he was not like the Nomos. Finally, he created the first single-sex beings, if that makes any sense to you. You really do have to read the book because it does try to explain that mythology.
No, well, I'm fascinated by the different beliefs in how this opens up and reveals itself. And I'm always curious about so many people speak about these races so matter-of-factly, but the information, it seems, is mostly incomplete. And a lot of it's theory and conjecture on the parts of the different philosophers that are discussing this. Why do you think that at this point, first of all, if that culture existed and was wiped out, why would it be kept secret from us? We understand that there have been civilizations that have come and gone. We understand there are some mysterious civilizations that have just vanished. Why would this be so important for them to dumb us down about?
Yes, that's a good question. Look, the feminine has been replaced. I mean, like, I will go as far as saying every time in Malta there's a church, something like 356 churches on a very small archipelago, even cave chapels, and, you know, there's probably about two or three per sort of town, and be guaranteed that everywhere there's a church or a chapel, there's some sort of a temple, Neolithic temple or sacred site beneath it. And it's, I mean, I suppose the patriarchal took over religion, and I suppose it was comfortable for them to, you know, to take over religion. And the feminine approach has been completely replaced. And I don't really think that's a good place to be, because we need both approaches. We need a feminine and masculine approach for...
And you believe the Atlantean race and such was based more in a matriarchal society?
Yes, definitely. In balance with a patriarchal approach as well. I think it was a more balanced balanced race, and I think that there was less war and you know, just violence as well that we see.
Geez, I don't know about that. I've got three daughters that live together that want to kill each other constantly.
Oh, yes. Well, look, you know, there are many females, I agree with you, that are very patriarchal. And sometimes you do need to be patriarchal to survive in this world that, you know, we live in.
Right.
But, I mean, look, and same with, you know, the patriarchal. Sometimes you come across a man that's more, you know, matriarchal, more balanced, you know, more in touch with his feminine side.
And I'm looking right at him right now, Tim, my co-host. That fits him perfectly. Definitely more in touch with his matriarchal side. The idea that Atlantis existed, was it coexisting with a water world and a world here on terrain, or was Atlantis all over at one point, do you believe?
It can't be. I don't think it was everywhere, because there were different races of humans. You know, you've got the Lemurian race, the Hyperborean. There were many different races. There were three destructions, I think. We do have other civilizations flourishing, which doesn't mean that Atlantis was every underwater city discovered. So we've got Lemurian in the Pacific, Hyperborean in the Atlantic, and the Polarian in Antarctica, that rose from the destruction of the previous civilization. So I don't think that every underwater city discovered is Atlantis.
Okay. We've got a lot more to cover, and we'll continue talking about some of these other finds and the information that she's been given over this this long journey of research. Moira Lesquier. Oh, God, Tim, my mouth is just not going to work in these names. Moira Lesquier is our guest. Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way right here on Beyond the Darkness.
beyond the darkness.
All right, we're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. And today we're talking about some really intriguing aspects of our prehistory, Atlantis, Lemuria, all of these amazing cultures that may or may not have existed at one point. And we're talking with somebody who spent a long time researching and dipping into this part of our history and connecting with it in a spiritual way and in a historical way. Moira Lesquier. Damn, I'm just going to give up introducing anybody's last names anymore. I've become horrible at it.
Let me try it once. Yes. Is it Lesquier?
You're such a show off. Well, Moira's back with us for the remainder of the show. And one of the interesting aspects of this is the way you said this book was out. You know, I talk about all the research and work you did and history, but you were telling me off air this book was already written. What did you mean by that?
Yes, well, when I was trying to discover, you know, who this spiritual guide was, and he actually always scared me because he always came across like a bit like a Dark Vader in a, black hooded coat. I always saw a prominent bird beak, and then I associated the guide with Thoth, the Atlantean king, the scribe, with. You know, associated with the Emerald Tablets, writing of the Emerald Tablets, and that explains, I suppose, why when I was researching and I felt like I was guided, the book was already written. Plus, I had my great grandma. Like I never felt alone. It was just there to be written. It was there to be. The story was there to be said, to be made. Made available, like it's like a little bit of a missing piece of the puzzle. I feel like I've added something to that puzzle, and I feel like the location of Malta, that central Mediterranean location, has always been dismissed, perhaps because of its current size, it's so small. But in the past, it was a greater land mass, and the reason why I say that is because the dugout valleys, which are known as wets in Maltese, in the Maltese language, are way too deep for a small island to sustain them today. And that points to the fact that the archipelago was really a larger landmass, perhaps even connected to Sicily and Tunisia, Libya. And I make the connection to Leptis Magna in the book. And they go in search of the Temple of Hercules, which is believed, if you look at some of Ptolemy's maps, like Tabula Europa 7, this map places both temples on Malta. That's the temple of Juno and Hercules, to be in the vicinity on Malta or either in the surrounding sea. And it's interesting because those cart ruts that are found on land, the cart ruts are like dug out into the solid limestone, actually run off cliffs and into the oceans. And many divers and researchers have noticed that these dugout cart ruts continue out into the ocean, which is another example that Malta was a lot larger than what we can see today.
Right. And we know that land masses have been changing for centuries, right? And that there are these different upheavals that take, that have been seen, and they found remnants of some of these cultures under the water, streetways, roadways, buildings, things like that have made their way under. Do you believe that's just the land masses changing, or do you believe that is from this underwater civilization that once kind of had free reign over our planet?
Well, after the last ice age, a lot of, we lost that land mass. So a lot of, land was lost. Around 9,600 BC, the last ice age. So a lot of land masses obviously shrunk because of the melting of the ice. As we lost, a lot of places lost their land, as the sea levels rose. I think, the evidence of, these cart ruts and megalithic buildings Neolithic buildings that have been found under the sea are evidence of past civilization and some form of industry, because Malta has the highest concentration of cart ruts in the world. So it shows that there was some sort of perhaps an industrial complex there. It's really quite unusual. No one really knows what the cart ruts are about. It's got everyone in a bit of a rut, really. No one knows what they were used for, but they're just there, engraved into the land. And no one really understands what their use is. We can only speculate.
Fascinating stuff. Let's talk about the translations as well, the different versions of the story through Plato and history. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Plato heard the story from one of his uncles, his great uncle, and then he went on his own investigations, and he heard the story from the Egyptian priest Sanchez. But Plato translated the text into ancient Greeks, and the reason for that is so that the ancient Greeks could identify with Plato's story about this Atlantean society. So, and everything was changed. Even the name of Atlantis was changed. So we don't even know the real name of this magnificent society that existed, that had mastered, you know, all sorts of technology, use of crystal technology. They had different skills. So we don't. It's all translated from Egyptian to ancient Greek, and then it was translated into Latin, then into modern Greek, and then into English. So understandably, some words can be interpreted in different ways. There are obvious errors in translation, and the book highlights all these errors in translation. And even Plato couldn't work out where Atlantis was, and he had to travel and to search for it. So, Plato never mentions the Pillars of Hercules. He describes the Steles of Hercules in his writing, which, according to the great poet Pindar, are situated in the centre of the Mediterranean. And other ancient historians mention the Straits of Messina as being the location of the Pillars of Hercules, which is between Italy and Sicily, and this being the location for the Pillars of Hercules. Now, what's interesting is that the Straits of Sicily did not exist in 9600 BC because it was above water, and one of many land bridges, and this would have made it easy for an army to easily just, you know, march over into battle with horse and chariot.
That's pretty remarkable. Now, you said that went out in search of it. Did Plato ever find what he believed was Atlantis?
Well, in my story, I put an answer to that question. So it's at the very end of the book. They discover, probably ruining it here for people who want to read the book, but they discover the association. Maybe I shouldn't tell you.
Oh, you're such a tease, Moira.
I am.
You are what, a tease or not going to tell me?
I'm not going to tell you, because you should read the book. Everyone should read the book. So, getting to the point, it was a battle fought on land, not on by sea. I think I've answered, to answer your question. So because there were land bridges, because sea levels were different, an army could have quite easily marched with horse and chariot onto Atlantean territory to fight the battle. But as it turned out, there was some form of cataclysm, and Atlantis sank within 48 hours, and, you know, there were heavy losses on both sides. Atlantis can't be the location of Santorini, Greece, because the Atlantis destruction occurred at least 9,000 years before Plato's time, and not when Thera on Santorini erupted, which archaeologists have placed at approximately 1500 BC.
You get a lot of great information for this book and doing this research, and you're getting it through guides and such. Did you ever figure out this guide that frightens you, this what'd you say, it was almost cloaked like a Darth Vader with a bird face?
Yes, with a large bird beak. He was always, I don't know, I just was frightened of him until I
Was he one of the races that once lived here, or is this just an ethereal or an eternal form, something that this is just what it has always been?
Well, I believe he was part of the race that existed before we were created here. And I associated him with, like, the master scribe Thoth that wrote the Emerald Tablets. So, as I was told, the book was already written.
Right.
And, you know, they would communicate through me to get it done. Once I started writing, I really couldn't stop. I just had to dedicate all my spare time to writing, finishing and writing it, because, it was just needed to be finished. Hermes is also known as Thoth as well. Hermes was known as to the Greeks as Thoth. So, and I feel like the communication has come through this guide that I associated with Hermes or Thoth, if you like. So, and then the influence of my great grandmother. She was, as I said, my first spiritual teacher. So it was easy to sort of put a story together based on my experiences with her, and then create characters around that and some form of a storyline.
Very cool. Well, Moira, how can people get copies of the book? Where can they find it? Is it available through all brick and mortar shops, online? What's the best way to get it?
Yes, through Amazon.com.
And it's Atlantis and the Legendary Blue Queen, correct?
That's correct.
Fantastic. Moira, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I know you've been busy and on the road. Thank you for dropping in and spending a little time here in Beyond the Darkness.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Have a great rest of your trip, and we appreciate you stopping by. Interesting stuff, right, Tim? I mean, I'm always intrigued by this aspect of the possibilities of what cultures came first. And I'm a believer that there were most likely other civilizations, especially because they keep pulling back layers and finding bodies and things that predate what they believed existed before. So it only makes sense to me that there's been something here for a long time, a lot longer than we're giving credit for.
You know, the one thing I got to ask the question, though, and it's an open question, mm-hmm. and whether you want to answer it, you can, or whether our audience wants to chime in, they can, or send us emails, or however they want to go about this. But it seems to me that Atlantis really exploded, or the idea of Atlantis as a actual searchable physical form really exploded when Edgar Cayce came on the scene and made it, made the details fleshed out a more physical form, gave it some credence, some real legitimacy. Am I wrong about that? Does it seem like once Cayce came forward and said, if you can find this, this, and this, then Atlantis is real? And people really started to give it some credence, some legitimacy. And at that point, it seems like that's when everybody said, you know what, Atlantis was real. I was there. I had this past life experience. I have this memory.
It became part of a plug-in. But did that – here's the thing, though, right? If you've got a bowl holding water, mm-hmm. that water doesn't go anywhere but in that bowl, that one vessel, till you crack it, and then that water comes through. Was Cayce able to crack that part of the Akashic records and memories, and the water came flooding back, the memories came flooding back to others?
Yeah, you know, I mean, until then, I mean, you think of Atlantis, and Atlantis was really the thing of fairy tale stories and comic books. I mean, it was something that when you said Atlantis, people kind of went, oh, yeah, you know, it's the stuff of fairy tales. We don't think much of it. We don't really give it much credence. You know, we think of it as something that it's the stuff of story. It's not anything that I'm going to give much belief to.
Well, but there's a lot of people that do. A lot of people that feel that they're reincarnated Atlanteans or Lemurians. I don't know. It's intriguing to me. Like I said, I do believe it. I believe that. I think, you know, they've proven that there have been different land masses that have sunk and risen and sunk and risen through history. And I don't know that it was necessarily an undersea kingdom as we would think of it. it may have just been a piece of land that was eventually swallowed by the earth, right? And that's it.
You would think, because a lot of times when they do find, as you put it, or as anybody would put it, an undersea kingdom or an island that's fallen to the bottom of the sea, a lot of times it is, like you said, it was a landmass that was there at one time that was above sea level, and for one reason or another, the seas have risen or fallen, or something's happened to where that landmass has eventually been covered up naturally by rising sea levels or right. whatever natural phenomenon's happened. The technology, I think, because of things like the Incans and the Egyptians, ancient civilizations that managed to come up with technology that was beyond its time, I think the Atlantean legend may have outgrown what might have actually existed there. Is that fair to say?
I get it.
That maybe we've crafted a tale so big we may not ever be able to prove it?
Well, obviously. And that's why I was trying to push for the question is, you know, when Plato's hearing it from a great uncle mm-hmm. and then, right. Another guy, and, you know, even though he's a religious leader, why were they in the know?
Right.
Why was this not more public? What made this such a secret society? Why would we continue to hide that aspect? Well, because we've been there before and it'll fall. That doesn't mean anything. You know what? I mean, listen, people go to NASCAR races and they know that sometimes people die,
mm-hmm.
right? And you go to air shows and almost know somebody's going to die at an air show.
Right. Yeah.
But it doesn't mean we stop going or we stop doing these things. That's human nature, right?
Exactly.
People haven't made it to the top of Mount Everest. They die on the way up there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And their bodies are now mile markers, you know, mm-hmm. along the path. It doesn't stop progressions. So, I think it's doing us as a humanity a disservice to say that, well, we couldn't handle it. Yeah, we could. We could understand yeah. that, and maybe we'd learn from those past mistakes that, we've been down this path and we self-exploded. Maybe that would be the important takeaway from all of this. And I think it's important to be heard, but that's why I can't see it being a conspiracy to hide it. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I agree with you on that point, because there's that same vein with UFOs too, in that, well, society just couldn't handle it. We turned on ourselves. We'd eat our own. We'd swallow up our own society. There is that point of us that, and there is a part of society where we do get very carnal, very animalistic, and revert to our own base animalistic instincts. But when we think of something as far as ancient civilizations go, and this is a whole different animal other than a living, breathing civilization that exists right now and is in our face. If you talk about ancient wisdom or ancient civilizations or something like knowledge that a secret society would have or something having to do with ancient technology, why wouldn't we be able to handle that?
Right.
To say that, and let's use Atlantis.
Well, because I guess it would undercut the belief in religion, and so much of our culture has been based on Christianity or religious law that it would pull those underpinnings out. And I think that there's, I'm not giving that as a good excuse, but I'm just saying I can see the fear behind that. And then you feel like if we take that away, people will drop in droves.
But really, we've had that kind of soft introduction to there could be other civilizations out there, even from the Vatican itself. By
on
them
other
saying,
planets, but yeah. I don't know that they've ever come forward to say, because they're, you know, the basic belief of religion is that we've only been here for, you know, 6,000 years or something,
right?
2,000 years, 6,000 years, whatever it is. So I don't know. It's a weird.
Well, much
weird part of our world.
Much like any good storyteller, anyone who can spin a yarn, you would think the Vatican would be able to come forward and say, well, you know what? It's you know, an alien civilization could have come along and helped these people in the 6,000 year time frame and could have helped the civilization along. And it could have happened in this time frame, and we'll fit it all neatly into our canon and everything will be okay. And it all fits within the church's
I know, but then, that's too much work. Then they've got to, you know, once you start telling a lie, you have to know every aspect of that lie or the lie falls apart.
True.
Right? So
true.
I think that's part of why, you know, it's easier to just say it doesn't exist But I don't know. I think we're coming to a point of where we need to be re-enlightened to the reality. It doesn't mean that that makes God any less important.
No.
Or Christianity, no, or whatever belief system you have any less important. I think I'm starting to really believe that these beings do exist. Each and every one of these godlike beings exist and are as powerful as we give them the ability to be. And that's not blasphemy, and that's not a bad thing. I think that we need enlightenment and we need a leader to follow. And if the basics comes down to, listen, you just have to be a good person. Well, says who? All right, God says so. Who's God? God created everything, so he's the one in charge. You must. So I think that it's kind of followed in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see even Christianity questions their belief systems in a lot of ways. And I don't think that makes sense. I know I'm getting some listeners probably rolling their eyes or planning to never listen to us again because I dare to question the belief system. I still have a belief, and I still have a relationship in my heart. I wouldn't post prayer and healing requests. I wouldn't be a part of that world if I have no faith in it. It would make no sense to me.
Right.
But I've seen things happen. Is it because we've all come together as one, and because of that, that focal energy allows us to have this kind of ability and we can make changes? I believe there's a lot to that aspect of our ability.
Absolutely.
That we just haven't created. And maybe that's what the Atlanteans and the Lemurians and the rest did. And maybe they were a parable and never existed, but they were an idea of walk before you run.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Don't get too close to the sun, Icarus, right?
Exactly.
You've got these abilities. It doesn't mean you're a god and you shouldn't take it that far. You know, you should still be humbled by the abilities that we have. So
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think
that's rare because, again, I told you I'm not good at building things. So,
well, but
usually one day, I hit my thumb
one day at a time there, yeah. Son. Yeah, I think you can get there. I think I think you're right on there. I think that's what Atlantis was meant to be. I think it was meant to be a parable. And I think we've taken that story and I think we want it to be so true so desperately that I think some people do take and they spin it off and say, you know what, I was there, I was part of it, I feel a connection to it. Well, the reason you feel a connection to it is because you want something greater for yourself than maybe what you have.
Right.
You know?
Well, and it's okay
and it's okay to want that.
Right, and it's okay to realize it going forward that mm-hmm. we can, you know, you have to strive, you have to have these goals in order to move forward.
Yeah.
And if the idea is, let's be better than we were, and let's learn from mistakes of the past, which we haven't, right?
No.
We're still a warring, nasty civilization, yep. As enlightened and powerful as we think we are.
Yep.
We're still just a bunch of play yard bullies pushing each other around and trying to piss a circle around each other and who's bigger and badder and more in charge.
Right.
And, you know, that's why I believe alien races might not be here. They may be watching us, but maybe it's just this, wow, what a dysfunction. We are like the Osbournes of reality alien TV, right? They just watch us and shake their head going, what the hell am I watching? This is absurd. We're not going down there.
Well, and to add to your point, if you were, let's say you're an archaeologist, and look at an alien species that's traveling the galaxy as an archaeologist. And you're going to find out about a civilization, and you come to this planet, and every time you turn around in any corner of the globe at any time, you've got different civilizations that are picking each other off or destroying each other. Would you want to go into that area and discover anything? I mean, you're putting yourself at risk. So, yeah, if they're out there and they're hovering around in a spacecraft, I wouldn't want to touch down and take a look at you either.
Right.
You know, if you're picking each other apart, I wouldn't want anything to do with that. And I wouldn't know if you look at all the different conflicts. And again, this isn't a political statement, but if you just take a look on this planet at all the different political conflicts and different areas of the globe, you can't count them. You can't sit here right now and name every single warring conflict that is going on Earth right now. There are too many of them. It doesn't matter how many skirmishes you can rack up. There are too many of them right now. So if you're an alien out there sitting on the edge of the atmosphere and you're thinking, I got to pick a place to land and try to figure out what these people are all about, there's really not a great safe place to land.
No.
So yeah, I don't blame them.
There's not.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, that's it for tonight. Tomorrow night, we'll lighten it up. Dr. Raymond Moody will be joining us. And I love talking with Dr. Moody. Fascinating guy. And it's been a while since he's been on the show. So please make sure you tune in and check it out. Plus, a brand new Theater of the Mind. And this is the second week in a row, Tim, a story from my personal experiences.
Oh, wow.
We're going to talk about my Oracle of the Dead experience, the Psychomantium experience at the Palmer House Hotel.
Oh, wow.
So that's tomorrow on the show. So I really enjoyed last week's, by the way. I think you did a great job with the effects and everything. Thank you for fleshing out my my experience. Because you know what's neat is I'm putting all these stories together so that I've got them on a disc to give to my kids. Mm-hmm. So when I'm long gone, they can play, "You want to hear what a psycho your grandfather was?" This crazy old bastard believed these things, and they can play them for them. And that part of my history will always be around for my children to hear the weirdness that made me Darkness Dave. So good job on that. All right. Well that's it for tonight. Timmy, we will talk to you again on Monday.
Absolutely.
And we've got another brand new week of shows coming up next week. And Tim should be a part of a couple of those with us as well. And then hopefully in the next 2 weeks, we're going to be back to full strength and recording together every day. So that's it for tonight. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow with more in the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.